hours. I think I see what's happened, Rennie said. The 10 men were carrying sealed instructions, to be opened in certain circumstances, maybe, or else just when they got here. It makes sense, said Sticky. Mr. Curtin knew they couldn't use radios or phones, and he doesn't trust anyone to know all his plans ahead of time. He was careful enough to be pretty vague, said Kate. I know 2100 hours is 9 o'clock, and rendezvous means to meet somewhere, but where? And who or what is this Abbott edifice? Is it a person or a place? Sticky furrowed his brow. It's kind of both. An edifice is a building, and an abbot is the superior of an abbey or... Slow down, said Kate. An abbey is a kind of church, right? It can be, Sticky said, speaking slowly. Abbey usually refers to a convent or monastery under the supervision of an abbess or abbot. But sometimes the church in one of those places is called the abbey as well. Okay, said Kate. So they're going to meet up again at 9 o'clock at a certain convent or monastery. Definitely a monastery. The note says abbot, not abbess. A monastery, then. And they're going to search one of the buildings, Kate said. But which monastery and which building? Wait, Rennie said, jumping to his feet. A monastery is where monks live, right? So isn't the abbot a monk, too? Mr. Curtin isn't just being vague. He's using code words. Of course, Sticky said. So Abbott Edifice is code for the monk building, Kate cried. But why search there? Rennie said, his eyes darting back and forth. Unless... Okay. Mr. Curtin must know that Mr. Benedict has a connection to the monk building. So maybe, if the 10 men didn't find everything they expected to find here, then Mr. Curtin's instructions would send them to look there, Kate said. And glancing at the wall clock, which fortunately was battery-powered, she added, In 15 minutes, we need to tell Milligan, and she dashed from the room. Rennie and Sticky followed as quickly as they could, but Rennie stumbled over Sticky's bag in the hall, and Sticky stumbled over Rennie, and by the time they got downstairs, Kate was waiting for them, bouncing up and down impatiently. We're too late. He's off with his sentries already. What about Mr. Benedict, Rennie said, or Rhonda, or number two? They're all surrounded by officials, and Mr. Bain's right there with them. And no, we don't have time for this. It'll take ages just to get Mr. Benedict by himself. But if the 10 men are looking for something important, then we need to get there first. With a jolt of alarm, Rennie realized that Kate meant to go to the monk building herself. But before he could argue how crazy this was, she held up the key Milligan had given her. I can take the secret passage. They'll never see me. I'll check the peepholes first, so if they're already in the office, I won't blunder in on them. And if they are there, I can spy on them. Oh, slow down, Kate, said Sticky. We need to... But there was no slowing her down. She was off to the front door before Sticky could finish. Rennie said, if we can't stop her... I know, Sticky said, hurrying after her. We'll have to go, too. When they reached the front door, Kate was halfway across the courtyard and heading for the gate. Striding along with her, though none too steadily, was the bedraggled Miss Plug. The police officers had moved off to usher neighbors back inside their homes, and the dazed chamber guards still sat on the steps. No one appeared to question what Miss Plug and her young charge were doing. "Said you were to stand guard in the yard," Kate was saying, as the boys caught up to them, "and absolutely no one else is to know." "What is it you hope to find down there?" asked Miss Plug, who seemed grateful to have been given a duty. "I can't say, but it's important, and you're not to say anything or let anyone come down there, and we have to keep quiet ourselves. We?" Miss Plug turned and saw Rennie and Sticky behind her. "Oh, hello, boys." So don't bother calling down to ask if we're all right, Kate continued. And when the guard's brow wrinkled, she added quickly, Sorry, Miss Plug, I explained more, but we have to hurry. The car gets here in half an hour. Half an hour, Miss Plug repeated, and checked her watch. They were across the street now and hastening toward the cellar doors. Sticky was pleading with his eyes for Rennie to stop them, and Rennie wanted to, yet he couldn't bring himself to do it any more than Sticky could. All it would take was one word to Miss Plug about what Kate really intended. But then what? Confusion, argument, delay? The 10 men would get there first, and then what might be their only chance to stop Mr. Curtin would be lost. Rennie couldn't fathom living with that knowledge, so despite the warning bells in his head and the revolt in his belly, he held his tongue, and down into the cellar the three of them went. "Glad you're coming," Kate whispered. "But you know I can't wait for you. I need to run fast." Holding her flashlight under her arm, she directed it at the metal door and inserted the key into the lock. "If I'm in trouble when you get there, you can hurry back here for help." She turned to reassure them as the door swung open. "Don't worry, though. I won't be in trouble." "Wait," Sticky said, jumping forward to catch her by the arm. He missed. She was already several paces down the secret passage, but she stopped and turned expectantly. "Your flashlight. Remember to turn it off before you go into the anteroom. If it's dark in the office, your light will show through the peepholes." "Gosh, glad you thought of that," said Kate. "Thanks." And then she was gone. It was more than a year since they had been in the secret passage, and the boys entered the dank, narrow, gloomy tunnel with no little trepidation. Their crisscrossing flashlights swept not just the floor, but the walls and ceiling, too, annoying several spiders and centipedes into skittering retreat. Rennie swallowed hard.
"Rennie?"
"Not really," said Sticky, "but I suppose it doesn't matter." Together they counted to three, took a deep breath, and ran into the gloom after Kate. Tricky Lines and Heavy Traffic. Rennie and Sticky stopped at the end of the passage to catch their breath. Then again, when they neared the top of the dark, winding, seemingly interminable stairs. It wouldn't do to be panting and wheezing when they crept into the secret anteroom located on the Monk Building's 7th floor. Mastering his breath as best he could, knowing perfectly well that under the circumstances it would never fully settle, nor his heartbeat stop racing, Rennie kept up the count he'd begun in the back of his mind almost 15 minutes ago. Almost 15 minutes, but not quite. The 10 men shouldn't have arrived yet, which meant Kate should have had her chance to search the office. So why hadn't the boys met her coming back in the passage? He feared he knew the answer, and a minute later Kate confirmed it. "I stuck around to spy," she whispered, when the boys appeared at the top of the stairs. She was kneeling by the far wall of the anteroom, her eye to a peephole. She had set her flashlight on the floor lens down, so that only a dim glow emerged from around its rim. Kate tapped the flashlight. "Don't worry. I only turned that on for you two. I'll turn it off when they show up." "When they show up?" Sticky breathed. "Are you out of your mind? Did you search the office or not?" There was nothing there. Nothing at all. Empty file cabinets, empty desk drawers. It's all just for show. Or else the 10 men got here early and took everything. But it doesn't look that way. The place doesn't look ransacked, just empty. I want to hear what they say when they discover the same thing. But, Sticky stuttered, trying to think of a way to change Kate's mind. The 10 men were probably already in the building. They were probably coming up the main stairs. But he didn't want to leave Kate behind. "That wall isn't very thick," he finally managed. "You realize that, don't you? If they heard us in here, they could smash right through it." "Oh, no doubt," Kate agreed. "So you'd better get settled. They'll be here any second." Rennie hurriedly glanced around to get his bearings before Kate switched off her flashlight. As long as he avoided the stairs, there was nothing to trip over or bump into. The floor was barren. So was the entire anteroom, save for the various garments, wigs, and hats hanging on the side wall. These were the disguises the adults donned on errand days, and a lever near Kate's head that opened the secret entrance into the office. "Don't bump that," Rennie told himself, as he knelt at one of the peepholes. "Whatever you do, don't bump that." Sticky must have been thinking the same thing. He veered so widely around the lever, it might have been a cobra. Then he took his position at the final peephole. Kate switched off the flashlight, and everything was suddenly impenetrably black. As if conjured by darkness, there came the sound of footsteps. The footsteps were followed by a thoughtful grunt, then a man's muted voice. "This one isn't marked. It would appear to be 7B, though." "Open it," said another, deeper voice. Peering through the tiny hole, Rennie saw a red glow in the darkness, like a hot burner on an electric stove. The lock, he realized. A 10-man had just aimed his laser pointer at it. The glow faded as quickly as it had brightened. Rennie heard the doorknob turn, and with a thump and a heavy shudder, the office door opened. Flashlight beams swept across the office. Rennie instinctively drew back. When he pressed his eye to the hole again, he saw two men. One of them, a huge, powerful figure with shining, well-coiffed brown hair, was undoubtedly McCracken, the leader of all the 10 men, and by far the most formidable. McCracken made an adjustment to his flashlight and stood it upright on the empty desk, where it shone like a lantern. With his intelligent eyes narrowed, he turned his head slowly from left to right, surveying the office. Beside him, the other 10 men, a familiar bespectacled man named Sharp, was doing the same, with exactly the same expression and movement of the head, so that the two men looked eerily like robotic figures you might see in an amusement park ride. Again, at the same moment, the men set down their briefcases. "Not terribly promising," Sharp observed. "I never trust promises anyway," said McCracken, in his two familiar, cool bass tones. "It's clearly out of use. Why does Benedict keep it?" "Perhaps he hasn't found anyone to take it off his hands. Times are hard for the gainlessly employed, my dear Sharp. In fact, Benedict used to maintain several offices here. But now he's down to just this one. At any rate, it only makes less for us to search, and search we must, if only as a matter of form." By "we," McCracken clearly meant Sharp, who cheerfully set to yanking out file cabinet drawers. As he did so, Rennie studied the office himself, wondering if Kate had overlooked anything. He recognized the room, of course. 7B had been the site of one of Mr. Benedict's tests. How well he remembered peering through these very holes with Sticky. They had only just met, as Kate negotiated a challenge the boys had passed moments before. The floor then had been painted in a checkerboard pattern, and the secret entrance had been a regular door. Now 7B resembled exactly the sort of dull office found behind every other door in the Monk Building, with a desk, file cabinets, bookshelves, a waste paper basket, and a potted ficus tree that had seen better days. Rennie saw nothing important in it at all. Nor did Sharp, who appeared to enjoy the search nonetheless. With a satisfied smile, he upended the desk, tossed file drawers here and there, ripped pastel paintings from the wall, and punched his fist through them. For good measure, he roughed up the ficus, whose last remaining leaves fell to the floor like sad confetti. Then he took a cloth from his briefcase and polished a scuff from one of his gleaming black shoes. "When will the others come?" he asked, breathing hard. McCracken checked his large silver wristwatch. Then he checked his other one. "Crawlings and Garrett arrive in 2 minutes. The others hold their positions, of course." "I do hate to wait," said Sharp. "Mightn't we get on with the instructions? It'll save time." McCracken laughed. "Sharp, what a fellow you are. All of us have to be present, or the number won't come out correctly. Would you like to follow the wrong instructions? Do you think Mr. Curtin would be pleased?" Sharp rapped his knuckles on his head, as if sounding for contents. Excellent point, McCracken. Well taken. No, since you put it that way, I believe we should wait. 2.5 minutes later, Crawlings and Garrett strode into the office. You're late, said McCracken. Sorry, said Crawlings. We thought we might have seen one, but no such luck. And no sign from the roofs? No. Very well, said McCracken. Let's sight our numbers, beginning with Crawlings. Each 10 man spoke a number aloud. McCracken nodded. The sum is odd. That indicates you, Garrett. Garrett reached inside his suit coat and took out a sealed envelope. He handed it to McCracken, who had already unsheathed a wicked-looking letter opener. McCracken slit the envelope, removed the letter, and let the envelope fall. As an afterthought, he sliced the envelope in two as it drifted to the floor. He didn't even look at it, before unfolding the letter and looking it over. Read it aloud, Rennie pleaded in his mind. Read it aloud. But McCracken only said, ah, and passed the letter around for the other 10 men to read. Excellent, said Crawlings, the last to have a look. He crumpled the letter and tossed it toward the wastepaper basket. That gives us plenty of time for coffee and scones. I don't know about you fellows, but I'm famished. You forget, said McCracken. We have to make another sweep for the girl. But take heart, my dear. If we don't track her down this time, we'll set up a watch in the neighborhood, and you can have something then. Sharp looked hopeful. Do you think she'll turn up before we have to go? I would so love a bonus. But, of course, we can't miss the rendezvous. With luck, she'll go crying back to Benedict's house well before then, said McCracken. With real luck, we'll track her down right away, said Crawlings. And, with a comical smile, he pantomimed drinking from a coffee cup and rubbing his belly. The other 10 men chuckled. As for that, said McCracken, I have a few more ideas. Let's signal the others and get moving. The 10 men filed out of the office, leaving it in darkness, and the young spies listened to their footsteps fading away. Not daring to whisper, Rennie mentally willed his friends to be silent until they were sure the 10 men had gone for good. For a long time, he listened with straining ears and was just about to switch on his flashlight when Kate switched on hers. "Did you see that?" Rennie whispered excitedly. Crawlings left the instructions. "I saw it all right," Sticky said. "Let's go." He trailed off, distracted by the sight of Kate heading for the stairs, and by the crumpled letter in her hand. "Wait, you already got it?" Rennie was staring, too. "I didn't even hear you." "I've been practicing," Kate whispered, already starting down the stairs. "Now, come on, we're going to be late." It was agreed Kate would run ahead in hopes of showing the letter to Milligan or Mr. Benedict as soon as possible. And, for the first time in ages, Rennie actually had hopes. From the 10 men's discussion, it sounded as though they wouldn't make their next rendezvous for some time, and Rennie felt sure Mr. Benedict could decipher his brother's instructions, whatever they were, quickly enough to act. It was a most promising turn of events, and Rennie couldn't help feeling proud of his part in it. Nor was he alone. Kate's feet had flown even faster than usual, and Sticky, puffing along beside him in the secret passage, kept spontaneously breaking into a grin. The boys' high spirits were diminished considerably, however, when they staggered up out of the cellar to find a miserable-looking Kate being chastised by Miss Plug, who had her by the elbow. A short black limousine with its lights on idled in the street. This must be the armored car. And from Mr. Benedict's house, in tones of rising alarm, the adults could be heard calling their names. "They're here!" roared Miss Plug, and relieved faces appeared in several windows. The guard plunged back into her tirade without missing a beat. "Looking for you, and no one seems to have had any idea of those orders Milligan supposedly gave me. And what was I to do? Even though I began to doubt your word, what if I was mistaken? No, I had to keep my mouth shut. I had to shrug and play it off as confusion. Meanwhile, the Washingtons are panicking. Miss Perumal is worried sick. Her mother had to take a pill. Do you know how it felt for me to stand here not saying anything to console them? Do you realize? I said I'm sorry, Kate cried, and I really am, Miss Plug. I can't explain how important it was or why we had to do it that way, but... Miss Plug was hardly mollified. Did Milligan give those orders or not? Did you or did you not have to search for something important down in that cellar? As the exact truth would surely have released fresh torrents of recrimination, Kate simply held up the crumpled letter. I have to show this to Milligan or Mr. Benedict. It's urgent, Miss Plug. Miss Plug snorted like a bull, glancing at the letter in Kate's hand. What is it? No, let me guess. You can't tell me. By now, Rennie had regained his breath enough to come to Kate's aid. We're sorry, Miss Plug, but it's true. We can't discuss it with you, but it is extremely important. Miss Plug's steely gray eyes roamed from face to face. All three children tried to look both humble and beseeching. At last she nodded curtly. Milligan isn't back yet. You can speak with Mr. Benedict in the car. Milligan's sentries just went in to fetch him. Here they all come now. Sure enough, out of the house spilled not just Mr. Benedict and the sentries, two men in plain clothes whose alert eyes started ceaselessly all around, but also the Washingtons, the Paramalls, Rhonda, number two, and finally Mucho Brazos, carrying four small brown bags. The children eventually discovered that the bags contained snacks for the police station. But first, they had to endure such tongue-lashings as they had never experienced, a frantic, furious scolding from all quarters, amplified by a need for haste. Across the street, without permission, without telling any of us, and in that cellar of all places, why on earth, searched high and low, have you any idea, young man? It went on like this at great speed and considerable volume for about 20 seconds. Then, all at once, it ended. And in a rush, the three of them were swept up and clutched and patted and even wept over, and their hair fussed with, in Rennie's and Kate's case, and clothes brushed off. They all had cobwebs and beetles on them. And in her confusion of emotion, the crying Mrs. Washington declared that Sticky was getting so big. And then, with earnest pleas to be careful and tearful promises to see them at the station, the children were bustled into the back seat of the armored car with Mr. Benedict. Throughout all this commotion, they had said nothing to defend themselves. In part, this was because they'd been given little chance, but it was also because Mr. Bain had sidled up and was observing the group with keen attention. Rennie, his eyes downcast as he mumbled apologies, had steadied himself with the knowledge that soon they could speak privately to Mr. Benedict. But it was Mr. Benedict who seemed to have the most pressing things to say. As soon as the car doors closed, he said, "I realize you have something to tell me. I see it on your faces, and obviously you had reasons for leaving the house. I have things to tell you as well, and the sooner the better. How urgent is your news? Must we discuss it here, or can it wait a few minutes?" The children glanced at one another. They were bursting to show Mr. Benedict the letter, and to see it themselves, for that matter. But they all had the sense it could wait a few minutes. "Very well," said Mr. Benedict. "We can begin after we've made a brief stop in the next block. There's no sense interrupting ourselves at the outset." And at a signal from him, the driver eased the car away from the curb. It occurred to Rennie that they had left behind their bags and jackets, but that hardly mattered now. "This is Mr. Hardy, by the way, and in the passenger seat is Mr. Gristle." The sentries glanced over their extremely wide shoulders and gave jaunty salutes to the children. Their faces, however, were deeply serious. Hardy was a tall, wiry man with tall, wiry hair that brushed the ceiling. Gristle was a blockish, balding fellow, with wisps of gray hair like scattered clouds. Their shoulders were so broad that they met between the front seats, and between them, the children had no view at all of the road ahead. But as the car headed out of the neighborhood and turned toward downtown, they saw through the side windows that traffic had begun detouring out of the congested main streets. With headlights as its sole source of illumination, the city seemed to exist only at street level. And yet, what it appeared to lose in height, it was gaining in breadth. As the normally dark back alleys were lit now by a growing stream of traffic. It was in just such an alley that the limousine pulled over behind a dilapidated taxi parked against a wall. Car horns blared as the sentries jumped out and stopped traffic. Mr. Benedict explained that they were changing cars. Bemused yet anxious to keep moving, the children quickly got out, squinting in the myriad headlights, and packed themselves into the back of the taxi. Then Mr. Benedict and the sentries leaped in. The tall-haired driver gunned the engine, and the taxi shot away up the alley, its rattling muffler echoing off the walls. "There," said Mr. Benedict, and as if they had just sat down to tea, he folded his hands in his lap and said, "Now that that's settled, we can have a proper conversation. I'll begin with why we've changed cars and why we aren't going to the police station." "We aren't going to the police station?" cried Sticky, already disturbed to have traded an armored car for a mere taxi. "The police station was the cover story," said Mr. Benedict. "We're going to a different secure location, and Milligan will meet us there when he can. The subterfuge was necessary because of Mr. Bain, who, as I believe you already suspect, is a spy for my brother." "We knew it," Kate exclaimed, drumming triumphantly on her bucket. She was holding it in her lap. "We knew something fishy was going on ages ago, didn't we? But you said, what did he say, Sticky? That it would be imprudent to speak of it further," Sticky said. "I'm afraid it would have been," said Mr. Benedict. "If you had known Mr. Bain was a spy, you would have found it difficult to behave normally around him. It is a strain always to be acting, and I preferred to spare you that. Furthermore, I could not chance Mr. Bain's discovering that I suspected him, and were he to overhear an incautious comment from Constance, for example, in a fit of temper, we would lose a key component of our defense." "But how is letting a spy guard your house a defense?" Kate asked. "We discovered that LaDrotha had worse plans," said Mr. Benedict. "He intended to make a desperate, terrible attack that would have resulted in far greater casualties than we've yet seen. But this was risky to my brother as well, whereas with a spy in place, he could wait for information that might lead to a better opportunity. And so I allowed Mr. Bain to be kept on, having already determined him to be the least dangerous of my brother's spies. He is not thoroughly wicked, you see, though he has a weak character. As you saw tonight, he was terrified by the 10 men. I believe he got in over his head, as they say." "So you weren't worried about him trying to kidnap us or anything?" Kate asked. "Actually," Mr. Benedict said, "that was one of the few things I didn't worry about. I had set an abundance of precautions in place, you see, far more than you're aware of, since by necessity many were kept secret. And at any rate, I considered the four of you more than a match for Mr. Bain." Kate beamed at this last remark, so obviously sincere and stated so matter-of-factly, and with which she entirely agreed. And the boys, somewhat less confident, felt a stirring of pride nonetheless. "Not that I expected you to be tested," Mr. Benedict continued. "Milligan's sentries were on high alert, and if not for this complete power and communication outage, which I am sorry to say I failed to predict, the 10 men could never have reached the house. As for Mr. Bain, I was confident he would never personally harm any of you. Not directly, I mean. It's true he never did anything worse to us than snap and snarl," Sticky reflected. "Until today," said Mr. Benedict, with a pained expression, "as we have just seen, under certain circumstances, even indirect action can do terrible harm. Indeed, my task all along has been to manage the circumstances so that everyone was safe. And I do mean everyone, from any potential wicked actions, indirect or otherwise. Mr. Benedict started to say something else, no doubt an apology or an expression of regret, but then seemed to think better of it, perhaps to avoid the children's inevitable protest. "That was an awfully tricky line for you to walk," Rennie said after a pause. "A treacherous one," Mr. Benedict said in a somber tone, "but necessary, and it had the potential of creating a lead to my brother. This was why I didn't have Mr. Bain arrested on the spot after he let Constance run away, and why I tried to mask my suspicion. He may not have offered much of a lead, but he was all I had. He still is, I'm afraid. Arresting him might spoil our chances of retrieving the Whisperer and Constance before it's too late." The children were eager to reveal that they possessed a new lead to Mr. Curtin, but before any of them could speak, Mr. Benedict's head lolled forward, his spectacles slipping from his nose. As Kate tried to shake him awake, it dawned on Rennie that Mr. Benedict's voice had faltered at the mention of Constance's name. Of course, he was incredibly worried, upset, probably guilt-ridden. He'd let Mr. Bain guard his house, after all, and Mr. Bain had let Constance go. Yet his manner had been as calm as ever, and Rennie, his mind in a whirl, hadn't realized that Mr. Benedict's composure was the product of great effort. In fact, it was a house of cards, and just the thought of Constance in danger had sent it tumbling down. "Try tickling his nose," Sticky said. "That worked once." But before Kate could try it, Mr. Benedict started and sat up straight. He turned apologetically to the children, resettled his glasses, and without wasting a moment said, "I'm afraid that may happen again, so let me speak quickly. For if the situation worsens, there are things you must know. The timing of my brother's attack is no accident. He arranged everything so that it would come to pass today. If Mr. Precious had succeeded in removing Constance from the house, Ledrotha knew I would go after her, and that Milligan would accompany me as a bodyguard. My absence, and Milligan's, was key, of course, for my brother knew that if he attacked while I was home, I would sabotage the Whisperer before he could possess it, and that Milligan would ensure I had enough time to do so. Mr. Benedict grimaced. "I would never have allowed that to happen, and yet I made a different foolish mistake by not anticipating what Constance in her agitated state might—" He fell asleep again. "Good grief," Kate cried. "What's the matter?" Hardy said, glancing in the rearview mirror, to see Kate holding Mr. Benedict's spectacles with one hand and shaking him with the other. "Is he all right?" "No," said Kate, exasperated. She caught herself. "Sorry, I mean, yes, he's fine. He's asleep again, but he's fine." "Well, the traffic isn't," Hardy returned darkly. "Even the sidewalks are packed, and I'd hope to use them." It was true. All over Stonetown, stranded subway trains and hopelessly stalled buses and taxis were emptying out, their passengers abandoning them to walk instead. This was a novelty for many people, whose confusion, combined with the apprehension the blackout caused, led to a disorderly crowd that spilled around the cars and flowed along the sidewalks like water streaming around the boulders and gushing down gullies. Mr. Benedict opened his eyes, rubbed his face, and instantly pressed on. "It goes without saying that Constance caught us off guard by running away. It was a lucky break for Ledrotha that Mr. Bain was posted at the back door today, though no doubt this was part of his original plan. If we had left the house to deal with Mr. Precious, as my brother hoped, then Mr. Bain could make some excuse and abandon his post just as the Salamander arrived, thereby eliminating any chance of a warning." "That's exactly what happened," Sticky said. "We saw him go around the front to talk to Ms. Plug, and the very next second we saw the 10 men. "Yes, it was well orchestrated, and I'm afraid it was only the beginning. Do you recall Mr. Gaines saying that the government's top advisers were being convened to deal with the Whisperer? If LaDropsa has his way, the Whisperer will deal with them. I'm certain he plans to obtain highly classified codes and passwords from those advisers, then use those secrets to his advantage. It will be the very sort of thing he's accomplished tonight in Stonetown, but on a much grander scale. I'm telling you this now, children, because the next 24 hours will be most chaotic, and we are likely to be separated. If the situation worsens, you and your families must leave Stonetown and go into hiding. Mr. Hardy and Mr. Gristle here will be assigned to help you and protect you. The children exclaimed in alarm. They were to go into hiding? Without Mr. Benedict? But what did he think was going to happen? What? Mr. Benedict, sadly affected by their dismay, fell asleep again. Look, what he was trying to get across to you, said Hardy sympathetically, when a long bout of pleading and shaking failed to wake Mr. Benedict, is that things could change fast. Mr. Curtin will want to get rid of anyone who knows the truth. Anyone who knows the Whisperer still exists and what it's used for. That means you and your families. Kids, sorry to say. Us too, of course. Anybody associated with Mr. Benedict, and, of course, Mr. Benedict himself. Especially him, said Gristle, but not before Curtin gets what he wants out of him. What would that be? Asked Rennie, feeling shaken. His voice was barely strong enough to be heard over the blatting muffler. Hardy shrugged. Answers about this sleeping problem they both have. Curtin knows Benedict was working on something that could stop it, right? Everything else Curtin can figure out for himself. But he wants to put the kibosh on this narcology. Narcolepsy, Sticky corrected. This narcolepsy, right. And he'll do whatever it takes. And he holds the cards now. He's got the Whisperer. So Benedict's got to find a way to catch him off guard. But that's not going to be easy, is it? We don't even know where he is. And even with Milligan on his side, and Gristle and me and the other agents he can trust, well, the odds aren't exactly good. By now, Kate was shaking Mr. Benedict so vigorously, she looked to be attacking him. Like the others, she wanted to believe Mr. Benedict could solve this problem, if only he could stay awake for it. But he was not to be wakened. His haggard, drawn face betrayed just how far he had pushed himself. Now his exhaustion was pushing back. In the front seat, Hardy and Gristle were muttering to themselves about the traffic, like a herd of turtles, Gristle kept saying, and how best to proceed. At present, they could hardly be said to be proceeding at all. 10 minutes passed, then 20, and Kate had no more luck waking Mr. Benedict than the sentries did reaching the next intersection. At last the men made a decision. Look, we didn't want to draw attention to ourselves, said Hardy to the children, but we're never getting anywhere if we don't do something. You three sit tight. He and Gristle got out of the taxi and began speaking to the drivers of the cars ahead of them, flashing badges and gesticulating. Apparently, they had some plan for clearing a lane. A plan would be good, Rennie thought. So much was happening at once, it was hard to keep even the simplest thoughts in mind before others flew in to replace them. Constance, the 10 men, Amma and Patty, Mr. Curtin, Constance again, and behind them, flashing with still more urgency now, was that mysterious sequence, that code or whatever it was, 133N292. What was that, anyway? For the first time since it made its appearance, Rennie had a moment to concentrate on it. He closed his eyes and tried to organize his thoughts. I give up, said Kate. I've tried tickling, patting, hair-pulling, you name it, nothing's working. Maybe we should go ahead and look at those instructions, Sticky suggested. We could try to work them out ourselves. You're right, Kate said, opening her bucket. Rennie, are you ready? But Rennie was thinking. Organize my thoughts? Organize, that's it. Sticky, he said, his eyes popping open. What do you think this sequence is? He described the code exactly as he saw it in his mind, including the space in the middle. Sounds like a call number, Sticky said instantly. You know, for a library book, a Dewey decimal number. That's what I thought, said Rennie. Listen, I think I know where Constance is. What? How? Kate asked. No time to explain. Sticky, does that call number belong to any book you know? A book in the Stonetown Library System? You memorized the entire catalog, right? Sticky thought a moment. Well, yes. It's the call number for The Myth of ESP by Perry Normal. I've read that book. It isn't very good. Sketchy research and... But where is it shelved? Rennie interrupted. Is it at one of the branch libraries or... Oh, no, there's only one copy in the system. It's at the main library. Constance is at the main library, Rennie cried. Kate closed her bucket, ready to move. That's not far from here. I can be there in 5 minutes. I should come, too, Rennie said. If she's still mixed up, she might give you trouble. Sticky, if Mr. Benedict wakes up, you can tell him where we went. Sticky frowned. The 10 men are prowling around looking for her, right? What if you get cornered somewhere? Or Constance runs off again, and you have to go after her, or... He shook his head. We have to stick together. You might need me. He's right, Rennie, said Kate. It should be all three of us. And the sentries, too, yes? Asked Sticky, trying to blink sweat from his eyes. His forehead had suddenly begun to perspire. I wish, but then who would protect Mr. Benedict, Rennie said. He'd be a sitting duck sleeping here all alone. Hardy and Gristle wouldn't leave him even if he wanted them to. Anyway, they probably wouldn't believe me. I can't exactly prove what I know. So we go alone, said Kate, and we go now. The 10 men could be closing in on her this very minute. Rennie reached for the door handle, then stopped and slapped his forehead. I'm not thinking straight. We should leave a note in case he wakes up before we get back, or... I'm on it, said Kate. Taking out a pen, she wrote Main Library on the palm of Mr. Benedict's hand, where it couldn't be lost or overlooked. Mr. Benedict twitched, snuffled, sighed heavily, and continued sleeping. Rennie was watching the sentries. They were several cars ahead now, talking to a bus driver. After a moment, they nodded, glanced back at the taxi to be sure all was in order, then moved ahead to speak to another driver. Now, Rennie hissed, throwing open the door. He leaped into the crowded street and was almost swept away by the throngs of people pushing their way through the stopped traffic. He clung to the door until his friends got out, too, and then, hanging on to one another and frowning in the headlights and exhaust fumes, the three of them made off into the night, hoping they weren't too late. Cowdozers and Rendezvous. The children soon discovered that the fastest way to reach the library was to cut through the downtown buildings. The streets were too congested to move freely, and though the buildings were dark, indeed because they were dark, they were relatively empty. The boys had unthinkingly left their flashlights behind, but Kate still had hers, and she led the way through whatever hotels, late-night restaurants, and corner malls they could find whose doors had been left unlocked. In some cases, doors had even been propped open to allow people to pass through, for the electrical mechanisms that opened them were not functioning. It won't be long till that changes, Rennie thought. If the power stayed off much longer, people would forget about convenience and start worrying about security. Everything that could be locked would be locked. But for the time being, people seemed to think the blackout would end any moment, or hoped it would, anyway, and were acting as though they believed it. In some places, they found it necessary to backtrack, in others to cut across a parking lot, which was what they were doing when Kate suddenly stopped in her tracks and looked up. Even in all the hubbub, she thought she had heard a familiar piercing cry. Sure enough, circling in the darkness above, along with a dizzying number of nighthawks and bats, was the much larger, instantly recognizable shape of her beloved peregrine falcon. "Oh, Madge, you followed me!" Kate shook her head wonderingly. She was very impressed. Madge must have seen her get into the limousine and followed it, then followed the taxi, then kept track of her despite all her shortcuts through buildings. She wanted to call the Falcon down and reward her with a treat, but there simply was no time. "Oh, do be careful, Madge," she cried, already pressing on. "I know it's confusing out here tonight." The boys took little notice of this exchange. Sticky was too busy keeping an eye out for well-dressed businessmen with briefcases, and Rennie was busy berating himself for not thinking clearly. Why, for instance, had he not thought to leave the 10 men's instructions with Mr. Benedict? Sticky could have memorized them with a glance and folded the paper into Mr. Benedict's hand. Too late now. And shouldn't he have realized sooner what the mysterious code in his head was? After all, he knew what Constance was capable of now, or at least he thought he did. And there had been other clues, too. Hadn't she been confused when she ran off? Hadn't it seemed she was reliving that fateful day when she'd sought refuge in the library? It should have been obvious to him that the code was a call number, Rennie thought. He needed to get his head straight and keep it that way. The Stonetown Main Library was a massive structure with columns in front and a peaceful courtyard in back. Like many of the buildings in the city, it was equipped with emergency lighting, but this consisted mostly of dim, battery-powered bulbs posted above doorways and in stairwells. The security guard, used to having more lights on, had found the vast, empty building too creepy to suit him, and was now sitting on the front steps, watching the traffic and the crowds. Rather than risk his refusal, which would only slow them down, the children circled the building, seeking a way in. Kate found one in the form of an unlocked window on the second floor. She discovered it by climbing up a drainpipe and checking window latches while Rennie and Sticky covered their eyes, terrified she was going to fall. A minute later, the emergency door at the top of the fire escape opened, and Kate appeared, smiling in triumph. Propping open the door with her bucket, she came down and lowered the fire escape ladder for the boys. They all knew the library fairly well, but it was Sticky who remembered exactly where every section was. They were on the right floor, he said, and they just needed to bear left. Soon Kate was shining her light along a row of books as they read call numbers. This was the spot. They could even see a gap where the book in question had been. And on the floor beneath it was a cellophane wrapper smeared with peanut butter and flecked with crumbs. "She must be close by," Kate whispered. No sooner had she spoken than from a shelf near her knees a head popped out and a voice cried, "It's you! You came! You got my message!" Rennie and Sticky yelled and tottered backwards, bumping into each other and knocking books from the shelves. Kate suddenly found herself looking down from the topmost shelf, having instinctively scrambled up like a startled monkey. The head, of course, belonged to Constance Contraire. They had found her. Constance was wearing her old red raincoat and boots, both of which were too small for her to be comfortable, but her excitement at being found caused her to miss a perfectly good opportunity to complain. In fact, it made her positively chatty. Riding piggyback on Kate as they hurriedly made their way back to the taxi, Constance chattered all the while. "It was so strange, like one of those dreams where people from all different places and times in your life are together in one spot. It really felt that way to me, like everything that had happened to me before was happening to me right then. Even though somehow I was in this new place with different people around me, but it was the past, my memory, I mean, that felt the most real. Oh, it's hard to explain how strange it all was. I caught a bus," she continued, "and asked the driver to take me to the library branch that was farthest away, just like before, right? But he checked his watch and told me I ought to go to the main library instead. He said because of the funding shortage, the branches had reduced their hours, and the one I'd mentioned would be closed by the time we got there. Well, that was nice of him, said Kate, though I wish he'd have told you to go back home instead. It would have saved us a lot of trouble. Kate's tone was somewhat breezier than she actually felt. She and the boys were having a hard time suppressing their irritation. It was clear from what Constance had told them that she hadn't been in her right mind when she ran away, and they knew it was unreasonable to blame a frightened 4-year-old for causing them such intense worry and trouble. Still, after all they'd been through on her behalf, the others would have appreciated a little more apology and a lot more gratitude. "So you meant to go to a branch library," said Sticky, in as neutral a tone as he could manage. "That explains why Milligan was in the Quarryside neighborhood. The branch library there is the farthest one away from Mr. Benedict's house. It's all the way across town." "Mr. Benedict must have guessed what you would do," Rennie reflected. "But he didn't know exactly when you left or what bus you might have caught, if you even managed to catch one, or whether you'd come to your senses and change your mind or anything." He cocked his head and looked at Constance curiously. "Hey, did you not try to send him the call number too?" "No, I was scared when the lights went out, but I felt pretty mad at him. I know I was mixed up, remember? So I focused on you instead." "Well, he's really worried about you. You should know that." "Is he?" asked Constance, clearly pleased. "I guess he'll be glad to see me then."
"You don't have to be so happy about it," Sticky snapped. "We've all been worried, you know, and we've been through a lot."
"Have you?" said Constance, as if this had never occurred to her. "Probably not as much as I've been through, though. Can you imagine what it was like for me when I realized what I'd done? Exactly the most dangerous thing possible, right? Here I was in the middle of the city with no protection, and then the lights went out, and people were frightened and hurrying for the exits. Oh, they tried to act calm, but their fear might as well have been shouting at me. It was all I could feel. And I wanted so much to come back to the house, but I was terrified, you know? I got this feeling that there were people out looking for me, 10 men, actually. Maybe my mind was playing tricks on me, I don't know, but I was really scared." The others made an effort not to look at one another, or even to think too much about the truth. They happened to know that the 10 men were looking for Constance, but it wouldn't do any good for Constance to know that herself. And then, as if to make a final play on their sympathies, she did what they'd all felt she should have done at the very beginning. She asked about them. "So you really have been through a lot?" Constance asked. "Like what? You have to tell me about it." She was looking about her with curious, wondering eyes. They were passing through a dark hotel lobby where a few weary travelers sat reading newspapers by flashlight. It was all very strange, and she felt rather as if she had awakened from one dream only to enter another. But in this one, at least, she felt less frightened and alone. "Later," said Kate, coming to a stop in the open doorway. "Right now we have a problem." She pointed down the street. The taxi was where they had left it, but it was unmistakably abandoned. Vehicles were creeping around it on both sides, blaring their horns and knocking bumpers in the confusion. The sentries and Mr. Benedict were nowhere to be seen. "Where did they go?" Sticky cried. "You mean they left without you?" said Constance, stunned. "Why would they do that?" "Well, if Mr. Benedict woke up," said Kate, "then he probably saw the note we left on his hand, in which case they'll be looking for us back at the library." "And if he didn't wake up?" Constance asked. This was Rennie's question exactly, and once again he wanted to kick himself for not having thought everything through. "We should have left a note where the sentries could see it, but we left it on Mr. Benedict's hand, where they wouldn't think to check. So they would have had no idea where to look for us, or whether we intended to come back. They may well have carried him away, thinking it was their duty to get him to that secure location." "I hope it was a hard decision," Sticky muttered. Well, where is this secure location? Asked Constance, looking round at them. Her face fell. Oh, you don't know.
The way I see it, we only have one decent choice, said Kate. If they aren't looking for us, they could be anywhere, right? It'll be almost impossible to find them, so I think we should go back to the library in case they went there. But this time, we stay out on the streets, because if they did go to the library, that's how we missed seeing them, by cutting through the buildings. What do you think?
Makes sense to me, said Sticky.
Rennie didn't answer for several seconds. He was determined to consider more carefully this time. You're right, he said at last. We should go back, even if we don't find them there. Mr. Benedict has to wake up eventually, and this way he'll know where we are.
We should have just stayed there, grumbled Constance.
Oh, great point, Constance, said Kate, rolling her eyes. They went back to the library. It took them much longer this time, and more than once they were jolted by the sight of a briefcase-toting businessman among the crowds. But these always proved to be actual businessmen, not 10 men. And the children arrived at the library without incident. Mr. Benedict and the sentries weren't there. Kate opened the emergency exit again to let the others in. After they had used the restrooms, and Constance had produced an armload of snack crackers, the librarians would understand, she insisted, and the others were too hungry to argue, they settled down to wait in a stairwell, where the emergency lighting would spare Kate's flashlight batteries. They didn't intend to wait idly. Kate still had crawlings as instructions, and they were keen to decipher them. As the 10 men had done earlier, so the mysterious Benedict Society did now. The paper was passed from hand to hand, each member reading it in turn. But whereas the 10 men had merely glanced at the instructions and grunted in understanding, the children shook their heads, partly in bafflement, partly in excitement, and quickly passed the paper on, mumbling to themselves. Constance was the last to see it. On the front was a note. Gentlemen, I have arranged for you to meet my most highly placed contact in government. He may be accompanied by certain associates, but you must bring him to me alone. Above all, you must be discreet. If our enemies learn his identity, all is lost. Do not fail me. Your rendezvous instructions are opposite. Sincerely, your employer. What does rendezvous mean? Constance asked. She pronounced the word as if it rhymed with Ben Says Mouse.
It's French, said Sticky. It's pronounced rendezvous. It means a meeting at a certain time and place. Your rendezvous instructions are opposite, means the instructions for determining that time and place are on the opposite side.
Oh, said Constance, flipping the paper over. I mean, I knew that.
If we can figure these instructions out, said Kate, we'll know where the 10 men are supposed to meet this highly placed contact, someone whose identity Mr. Curtin needs to keep secret at all costs. In other words, Constance, this is big. Constance, frowning, had flipped the paper back over to study Mr. Curtin's note. But what about the Z? It took the others a moment to realize what she was talking about.
It's silent, Sticky assured her.
Constance's frown deepened.
Well, that's stupid. Why not just leave it out?
How about we save grammar discussions for another time, Rennie suggested. Kate took the note from her and reread the instructions, which were as follows. In the route, by the mover, to the north, at noon.
He's using code words again, Kate said. Or maybe just vague language he knows they'll understand.
We ought to be able to figure it out, though, right? We figured out the last one. So let's put our heads together.
But though to the north and at noon were easy enough to understand, in the route and by the mover were not. And after several minutes of consideration,
The children had yet to come up with anything like an answer.
"I can't believe those guys figured it out so quickly," said Kate. "It hardly took them a second."